Welcome back to the Coffee Hour. I'm Andy Bates.
I'm Sarah Golseth.
While we were at the Sing Conference in Nashville, a conference all about hymns and congregational singing, Sarah had the opportunity to interview the conference poet in residence, Dr. Malcolm Geit, who has quite a story, and we'll share a portion of that story today. You can catch the full story in a forthcoming episode of the Lutheran Ladies Lounge, which I believe will drop in November.
That's the plan at the moment. Yes, November.
Sarah, can you tell us a little bit about your guest?
Yeah. So Malcolm Geit is a very exciting person. And we had a fantastic conversation that is about triple the length of what you're going to hear today. He is a poet, a priest, a musician, a life fellow of Girton College, Cambridge. So he has a British accent, but he is delightful to listen to. He's penned 5 volumes of poetry, several books on Christian faith and theology, including a highly acclaimed biography of Samuel Taylor Coleridge. And also, what was especially interesting for me and for our Ladies Lounge audience is his writings on J.R.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis. So we talk at length about fantasy in our full episode on the Ladies Lounge, which you can catch coming up in a few months.
Very good. So here is Sarah's interview with Dr. Malcolm Geit.
I'm a Brit. I use the word Brit or British quite carefully in that, I mean, I'm half English, half Scottish. So two of the kingdoms of the United Kingdom I cover both. My mother is Scottish, was Scottish. My father was an Englishman. Hugely formative for me, both of them. I mean, obviously everybody's parents are formative, but I'm particularly grateful to them. My mother, I mean, it's through my mother that the poetry comes. She was a great storyteller. She had an enormous fund of poetry. I didn't realize this was unusual until I started meeting other kids, you know, at school. And I would say, like, you know that thing when your mum recites the rhyme of the Ancient Mariner to you, and they go like, what? And I was like, doesn't everybody's mum do that? So she had this huge fund of poetry and song. Great memory. Her mother, my grandmother, were on that side, was a poet, was a published poet in Scotland and in Glasgow. So that sort of flows through there. And she didn't, it's not, I mean, to make it clear, it's not that she sat me down in a chair and said, this is poetry, it's good for you, you've got to have 10 minutes of this before playtime. It was nothing like that at all. She would just naturally, it would flow out of her, and you'd just feel the lift. So I was, in spite of being coming across as this very British person, I was actually born in Nigeria.
Yeah.
And my first name, in fact, is Ayodeji, which means joy again. It's a Yoruba name. But although we lived in Nigeria and then in Zimbabwe, my dad, you know, taught classics, Greek and Latin there, but we came back to England every year so that he could do his research in, you know, Cambridge. And my mother wouldn't fly. So it meant me and my sister went with my mother on these wonderful slow boats, as it were, from Africa every year. My mother had been in the Wrens in the war and was a real sort of sailing and, you know, sea person. So just to give you an example of you know, what she would do, we'd be stood together on the deck of the boat, you know, as the sun was going down, you know, in kind of the South Atlantic or something, and she'd say, out beyond the sunset, could I but find the way, is a sleepy blue laguna that widens to a bay. And there's the blessed city, or so the sailors say, the golden city of St. Mary. And I became like, what? You know, the idea of getting behind the sunset. So she would just do that, or she'd quote bits of the... So I was very fortunate that I grew up with that. And my father was, you know, keen on literature too. So I was... My grandfather had the theory that you should expose kids to the best literature from the get-go. Mm-hmm. So I literally had Milton and Shakespeare read to me in the cradle, you know. So it's all in there somewhere. So that was very fortunate. Then when I was 10, we left Africa. My dad got a job in Canada. Mm-hmm. He was a professor of classics at McMaster University in Hamilton. Mm-hmm. So I suddenly went from being a kind of mixture of British and African to being a Canadian kid. And then, you know, as I was about to go into high school, at the, you know, beginning of the 70s, my dad was worried that I was, this is very ironic, really, he was worried I was losing my British identity. So so he sent me to a boarding school in England. You know, it was a great school, one of the great the London schools, but it was very traumatic for me. You know, yeah. I'd never been away from home. I got what my father was doing and I agreed to it, but I didn't really know what I was letting myself in for. And yeah. I found that quite traumatic, the sort of being a lonely boy in a boarding school. Also this weird split identity where in term time I was a buttoned up English schoolboy. And, you know, in the holidays, I was a kind of Canadian kid listening to Neil Young and Joni Mitchell. It was kind of, you know, it's like, That was quite difficult to negotiate. And in the course of that, in the sort of crisis of, you know, all the usual adolescent Sturm und Drang, I lost the faith which I had, well, abandoned, I deliberately abandoned the faith which I'd received almost just by osmosis from my parents. But I was, you know, it was quite an aggressively secular school in its own way. And we were very much fed the agenda that, you know, all this religious stuff is from the childhood of humanity, and now we're grown up and we're there to know, and we leave these fairy tales behind, and science explains everything. But the science that explained everything was a very reductive science. Mm-hmm. It was just, you know, we're all just unwinding enzymes and the self-replication of a selfish gene, that stuff.
Yeah.
Which, you know, just does not account for any of the heights or depths of or innerness of human experience. Yeah. And so I tried my best to follow that, and I really went for it, and I was going to be a scientist, and I was, you know, I was a very ardent, strident kind of atheist in my mid-teens. Mm-hmm. But then poetry came back into my life, and poetry had always been there because, you know, and I was taken by one of my aunts to Keats's house in Hampstead Heath, and I didn't really know anything about Keats, but I stood in the room where the magic casements open, and there's the tree where the nightingale sang, and they had the Ode to Nightingale up on the wall, and I read it and was just completely mesmerised. I read it more and more, you know, and first of all, because it starts, you know, with you quite moody. I was a moody adolescent, you know, my heart aches and a drowsy numbness pains my sense, you know, as though hemlock. Yeah. But then, you know, he hears the bird and he's drawn out, and suddenly you get this beautiful, I mean, you get the thou light-winged dryad of the trees in some melodious plot of beech and green and shadows numberless singest of summer in a full throat. I was like, what was that? I was reading it again and again, and I was like the kid at the back of an Eric Clapton concert playing air guitar. You know, I want to sound like that. But you may remember in that poem, suddenly out of nowhere, you get two beautiful, they're not logically related images, but they're there. Suddenly, in the midst of this poem, appears the biblical figure of Ruth. Mm. He imagines that Ruth, too, has heard a nightingale. When sick for home, she stood in tears amidst the alien corn, you know. And I suddenly recognized my homesickness. Mm-hmm. But I recognized that there was a transcendent element to it. And then, of course, it finishes about magic casements opening mm-hmm. on perilous seas in fairylands forlorn. It's like there's a window at the back of the poem that's taking you into something completely transcendent. So now, Keats was not a Christian. It's not a Christian poem. The poem didn't in itself, you know, give me back my faith mm-hmm. and make me a Christian. But what it did, and I think all great art can do this, I mean, I think it's happening a lot now to some of the so-called new atheists of our own age. That's breaking up. Mm-hmm. And now we're having in England what's being nicely called a quiet revival. You know, anyway, the point is, what that poem did, standing in that house and reading it again and again, was it basically cracked open the kind of layers of concrete reductivism that I poured over the wellsprings of my own imagination, and it said, no, there's more. Whatever else is going on in this poem, it's more than firing synapses and unwinding enzymes. Mm-hmm. There's something. So what that poem did is it kind of cracked open the carapace and allowed me to be aware of spiritual resonance. It took a little longer. I got to Cambridge. I was fortunate to win a scholarship to study literature at Cambridge, and Cambridge has been in my orbit ever since, really. But I chose particularly to specialize in medieval and Renaissance literature. Mm. So everybody I read was Christian,
yeah.
You know, and trying to understand Milton, trying to understand Spencer, you know, I needed to read some background theology, you know, so I read Augustine's Confessions as a background.
Yeah.
And I sort of thought, well, that the thing about Augustine's Confessions, or anything by Augustine, but you walk into that book, and it's like going in one of those really little doors inside the big door in a cathedral. You go through the little door of the cover of the book, mm-hmm. and you're in this vast, capacious place. You realize this mind is very considerably more capacious and better furnished than mine is. Mm-hmm. So the entire idea that Christianity is for dummies, or that we've outgrown it, or that we're somehow more intellectually or philosophically sophisticated, you only have to read a theologian of that caliber to have that completely blown away. Mm-hmm. And you realize, you know, there is more than enough to satisfy the most rigorously searching intellect and to draw it further in, you know, in the Christian faith, in the gospel. So that was really important. Eventually, these things came together, partly also with reading the Psalms, allegedly for background to poetry. But I eventually had I realized there was much more to Christianity than I thought. I couldn't dismiss it so easily. I became skeptical about my skepticism. Mm. Eventually, God made himself a little bit plainer and clearer with a real sense of his presence in the room and various things. So I returned to my faith in end of 79, yeah. Which was beginning of my final year at Cambridge, and I was confirmed, in the Anglican Church in February of 1980. And of course, the great thing about returning to my faith was because poetry had had so much to do with preparing the way. I mean, I don't know if perhaps your listeners are familiar with C.S. Lewis's wonderful spiritual autobiography, Surprised by Joy.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
He says effectively, he's reflecting on reading George MacDonald, but he says in that book, I suppose in a way my imagination was baptized before I was,
yeah.
But the rest of me took a bit longer to catch up.
Yeah.
And that really was my experience. So because of that, when I then came back to Cambridge 10 years later and did theology as part of preparing for ministry, mm-hmm. I was really keen to think about the theology of the imagination, about the imagination as a kind of proto-evangelism, as a kind of opening up of possibilities,
yeah.
And the need to integrate reason and imagination together in a full, you know, apprehension of faith. So eventually I thought those issues through at a fairly fundamental level and wrote a book which was kind of my sort of academic monogram, which is a book called Faith, Hope and Poetry, mm-hmm. Theology and the Poetic Imagination. And I've developed those ideas since, but I was very fortunate to be part of what was the beginning of a renaissance, really, of theologically, of thinking about theology and the arts. I was working with Jeremy Begbie, who, you know, is a tremendous theologian of music. And that's been academically very important to me. But there came a point where I realized, actually, I'd always wanted to be a poet, so I didn't want... You know, the thing about literary criticism, it's wonderful, but you can almost end up killing your own creative spirit because you're too over-analytic. So I at a certain point in the course of my early ministry after my ordination, I reconnected with that earliest wish to be a poet.
Mm-hmm.
And I started wanting to be a poet in Keats's house. You know, I was a wannabe Keats, you know. Which meant that when I did write poetry and really focus on it, I was very interested in the music and the sound of the words and in craft and form, mm-hmm. which I felt was missing from a lot of contemporary poetry anyway, so that sort of became my niche.
Yeah, yeah.
So, long answer to a short question.
You've been listening to a portion of an interview with Dr. Malcolm Guyte for the Lutheran Ladies Lounge that Sarah recorded mm-hmm. with the poet in residence at the Sing Conference in Nashville. You can hear the full interview in a forthcoming episode of the Lutheran Ladies Lounge. And Sarah, you said that's coming up in a few months, maybe November?
It is currently scheduled for November, yes.
Very good. Well, watch for that on the KFUO website mm-hmm. and anywhere you get podcasts, you can look for the Lutheran Ladies Lounge podcast. You've been listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Andy Bates.
I'm Sarah Golseth.
The Coffee Hour with Andy and Sarah is a production of KFUO. To support The Coffee Hour and KFUO Radio, visit KFUO.org. You can also text KFUO to 41444 or send an email to gifts@KFUO.org. And you can call us at 800-844-0524. KFUO. Christ for you, anytime, anywhere.
The Concordia University System is comprised of 5 universities of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Located across the United States, the universities offer more than 160 undergraduate and 50 graduate programs and approach learning from a Lutheran context with the goal of developing Christian leaders for the church, community, and the world. Learn more about your Concordia University System at cus.edu. The Concordia University System, education built on God's Word. cus.edu.